I've been seeing a lot of things talking of the people making commentary. Interestingly enough, the ones I've noticed that have been making the commentary are wealthy black people making the commentary about we should not be rioting, we should not be looting, we should not be tearing up our own communities. And then there's been an argument of the other side of we should be hitting them in the pocket. We should be focusing on the blackout days where we don't spend money. But, you know, I feel like we should do both.
Well, the voice you just heard is my guest on this podcast today. And I have been, from the moment I watched her clip during the protests of the killing of George Floyd, I was struck by her. I went back. I grabbed as much information as I could about her. I tweeted about her. I tweeted out her clip. She is none other than Kimberly Jones, former bookseller and now the host of the Atlanta chapter of the popular Well-Read Black Girl Book Club, as well as the infamous viral sensation, the YA Truth or Dare author plant panel at the Decatur Book Festival. She has worked in film and television with trailblazing figures such as Tyler Perry, whom I love, Whitney Houston, who I love, 8-Ball and MJG. Oh, you're just doing it, girl. Currently, in addition, she is a director of feature films and cutting-edge diverse web series. She also regularly lectures on working and succeeding in the Atlanta film market, which is, I know, a tall order, having done a little work when I was at BET in that market. She is known for her work writing novels such as, and we're going to get into this, I'm Not Dying With You Tonight, co-authored alongside Gilly Siegel, which was a finalist for the NAACP Image Award. Kimberly, it is an extreme pleasure, and of all the guests I've had on this year, you're the one I wanted to talk to the most because you, I don't know if you really fully appreciate the impact of your words. My son and I have had this ongoing discussion about the structure of this country. And he and I get into some really heated debates. You know, he makes Bernie Sanders look like, you know, Ronald Reagan. And he's just, I mean, he is, but he's not progressive in the political sense. He's progressive in the human sense. It for him, it's not the politics. He doesn't want to deal with the politics. He thinks the politics is all bullshit, and he's right. But we get into these debates about the structure, the systems, the infrastructure of this country. And after I saw your clip, two things happened. One, I started to cry. And two, I sent him a text and said, I now get it. I get it. I get what you've been telling me for the past 2 years. It was powerful. It was, I think, a seminal moment. I think among all the things that have happened, it changed a lot of attitudes and opened up a lot of eyes. What was it? And the clip we heard was what I call the calm before the storm, where you just kind of drop some knowledge. You were sort of laying out some of the history, and you were being the author. You were sort of telling the story. Mm-hmm. What was it about George Floyd's murder and the subsequent reactions that led you to that moment where you just said, hell, this is it. This is what you need to know. How did that?
Yeah.
Was that a feeling? Was it a, cause you shook it. I mean, you just shook it.
Yeah. I think that I was just so exhausted with people redirecting the narrative to the looting and the rioting. I think that people were so comfortable discussing the what, because that allowed them to be in a very complicit place. So as long as you are just focusing on what people are doing, and let's be honest, the looters and the riots are a significantly small amount of the people who are taking to the streets and what's actually happening in the streets. This is a movement of the people. The people are speaking up for themselves for the first time in a long time, and not just nationally, but globally. And so I was really exhausted with the news trying to center property damage. And so I was just so disgusted by the fact that people were more concerned about property damage than the death of human beings for menial crimes. Because I'm just like, even if you want to lean into the narrative that these people at the moment in which these incidents were happening to them were doing something wrong, the sentence for these crimes are not death.
Right.
And one person cannot be judge, jury, and executioner in the street. That is not the way that this system is set up. That is not the way, that is not the social contract that right. we all have been led to understand. And so,
but that's how it's been applied to us. Right? That's how it's been applied to us.
Yeah. That's how it's been applied to us and, you know, black and brown people. And so it's like everyone else has this vantage point of seeing the police as, you know, the authority that steps in when there's, you know, a disruptive situation. But for us, they've been authoritarian. And if that's not your experience, you don't get to see it. So I was downtown Atlanta and people were cleaning up and their entire conversation was about how horrific the looting was. And I was struck by that and I was upset by that because I'm like, no one out here is having a conversation with me about the horrific nature of someone kneeling on someone's neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. Your concern is that someone has written on a building. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are certain people who have, you know, cut up my message for their own point to say, well, she's pro looting. And I'm like, no, I'm pro looking at the why of things.
Hey, pro, is that a thing now? We can be pro looting. Like, what the hell is that shit?
Yeah, they're like, she's into looting that one.
Oh, jeez.
And I'm like, okay. You didn't hear a word I said.
No, they didn't. No, they didn't. And that was what's so powerful about your response, if you will, to what you've just described, was you made them listen. And it was it. And I guess for me, it gets to the question when I'm looking at triggers. I'm out of the world of politics and business. I'm always looking for triggers. You know, one thing leads to another. Something triggers something else. And it, you know, it catches on, you know, it's a catchphrase, it's a promo, it's, you know, whatever. Why do you think that the killing of George Floyd caused such a huge resurgence in the Black Lives movement? For example, you got white folks around here running around now embracing Black Lives Matter like it's like, you know, Coca-Cola. I'm like, wait a minute.
Yep.
Five 5 years ago, you mofos were out here cussing out anyone who would even mention. But first rejoinder was all lives matter. And now you starting conversations. Let me just say before I begin, Black Lives Matter. I'm like, OK, bitch, whatever. Gotcha. What? I'm sorry, but we only been saying this for 400 damn years. I mean, okay, so I'll get off.
Few years.
Okay, I invited you as the guest. I'm gonna let. I'm not gonna rant. I refuse to rant. I'm not gonna rant. So back to the question: What is that all about? Because I'll dovetail into this. Colin Kaepernick took a knee to express. Mm-hmm. His personal outrage. That was his personal protest. I love my flag. In fact, I love America, but America, you're wrong. So I'm going to show you in a respectful way, I think you're wrong. He was told by a Green Beret, take a knee. That's how we show respect. And you got everyone from Trump to the NFL blasting him, calling him names, kicking him out of the league. And now today everybody's like, well, oh, yeah. Oh, Colin was right. Well, I was with Colin all along, and I just don't understand.
No, you weren't.
Thank you.
So, you were not.
What happened?
You were not.
Was it the death of George Floyd? Was it the reaction to the death? What do you think was that trigger that got people now starting conversations with BLM?
I think the trigger was the pandemic. I think that was the trigger. Yes, because I think what happened was that for the first time in this very fast-paced world that we live in, people were still. And people who by nature have a good heart that had hustle and bustle. They had to go to work and get the kids to soccer, and they were watching the football and doing whatever it is that they were doing, and they glossed over the Black Lives Matter movement, and they, you know, they sent $100 and they tapped like on something, and they had this very passive allyship. They're now sitting still. They don't have anywhere to go on Tuesday afternoon, and so they do have the time to sit and watch the full video of what happened to George Floyd and consume it and have conversations with their friends of color and actually pay attention to what was going on. And like, it's Tuesday and I don't have a job to go through. I got right. time today. So I'm going to march through the streets and do what I have to do. And yeah, and I think, and the thing I love the most about what's happening in this movement right now, that it is led by the people. And so the common everyday man started taking to the street. Listen, these corporations are full of shit. I want to see some actionable plans from them before I start patting them on the back for these false statements that they're giving, where they were giving completely polar opposite statements 5 years ago, 4 years ago, even a year ago. And I think what's happening is they, again, which is why for me, everything reverts to economic and buying power. I think before this looked like it was an issue of poor blacks, which it isn't. It's just an issue of being black in America. Right. Mm-hmm. But I think they relegated it to thinking that it was an issue for poor blacks. So it was something that they didn't have to be concerned about because it wasn't affecting their bottom line. But when they saw Karen and Becky mm-hmm. and Sue and John taking to the streets and passing information, talking about which companies are complicit and which companies are supporting who and all of that, they got panicked because not only was it a national conversation, but it became a global conversation. And they realized, oh shit, we might be in trouble. Everybody around here getting woke.
That's right. Y'all been woke up fast because, and it's interesting how it does come back to money. I mean, to your first point mm-hmm. about people being concerned about burning the target, and I loved that moment in the clip where you were like, fuck your target. You know, it's like, that's not what this is about.
Then it hit me later. I was like, oh, Target carries my book.
Wow. But you raise a good point. It is that commercial interest that has kept mm-hmm. us, what's the word I want? Has kept us asleep on racism. Mm-hmm. Over these last 400 years, from the very beginning, it's always been about the commercial interest, the value of not having to, you know, stir that pot and really look at the ingredients you have in that pot and realize that's where the funk is coming from. And you can't cook this anymore. You got to, we got to throw this out. They get you with that mm-hmm. commercial interest because, You're going to talk about us? Guess what? We just won't sell your book. We won't sell your product. But what's happening, I think, to the core of your statement is people are like, you know what? That's fine. Don't. Because we don't own it anyway. We don't have that interest isn't ours. It's yours. It's not mine. Yeah. And you took from us, you referenced Tulsa, you referenced, you know, what was it?
Rosewood.
Thank you. You drew attention to where black wealth was centered and created and what white folks did to that. So don't tell me now I need to be concerned about your target when you already blew up, burned down and killed people in our community over our economic interest. Yeah. And I think that the point you're raising is about the pandemic is important in conjunction with this economic piece because, where are you going to go? You don't have the job. You're not going into work. You probably aren't in a Zoom meeting. So, all right, what are you going to do? This thing happens and boom, you're now in the narrative and you have to watch 8 minutes and 46 seconds.
Yep. And it's life-changing because we share those videos amongst our community, but it's disturbing to us, but it's not life-changing to us because we know these things happen and we know that they're not just relegated to certain communities. We know they're not directly connected to raw criminality, which is another, view that people try to give of it. I've been a victim of police brutality myself.
Yeah.
I got pulled over and were harassed by five officers who drew their guns down on me, and I had to defuse the situation and start telling jokes and let them know that I was a writer in order to get out of there with my life, is how they made me feel, you know, in that moment. And so it's not just relegated to poor people and people with a criminal background. And again, I go back to, even if the person does have a criminal background, the sentence for these crimes, the Eric Garner's selling, you know, cigarettes, the sentence for that is not death. The sentence for that is not death.
So I want
to... We have to have the same liberties.
Yeah, well, the Constitution says we do, right?
Yeah, allegedly.
It's words on paper. It's that living out those words on paper where we get tripped up all the time. And it's a fascinating tale, in the sense that when you look at how communities of color and white folks react to intense violent moments, when I go back and I look at the 1960s, and I remember as a kid watching the riots, they literally occurred outside my window. I grew up in D.C., so it wasn't much to walk over to 14th Street and see the devastation and the frustration and the anger. I remember as a young kid, my mom not being able to take me to certain parts of D.C. Because those parks and those communities were for white only. The neighborhood she moved into in Petworth back in the 1950s was white, and she was one of the first blacks to move in there with her husband, and white folks got up and left. And they were like, oh, hell no. Well, today, that neighborhood, all those white grandkids are back. They've regentrified the neighborhood. Now it's good to be
something?
Now it's good to be back in the neighborhood, right? And they wonder why black folks are frustrated. They wonder why we look at this and go, wait a minute, we just wanted to come in and live with you in peace and harmony. You moved your ass out. So we established a neighborhood.
Right.
You don't invest in it. You know, we don't have all the things and all the little shops and things that you have, but we made it work. And now you coming back and buying up stuff and acting like you've been here all along. And I'm sitting there going, that's why people get frustrated. And you talk about...
Yeah, and not only acting like that, but like disrupting the community of the neighborhood now. Like, I'll never forget, because the neighborhood that I live in is now being gentrified. And it was one of my white neighbors who was frustrated the other day because they were harassing this old black man who's lived in his house for 50 years because his yard is a little bit overgrown. He's 84 years old.
Right.
And so it gets done when he can get it done. And so someone in the neighborhood, a new person to the neighborhood, actually called the HOA on him. And I was just like, are you serious right now? Like, you move in and become a disruptor to the peace. So now we've all decided to make a list of us taking turns to do the upkeep on his yard because some asshole just moved in. You've been here for 5 minutes and already you have not tried to get to know anybody. You have not tried to communicate with anybody. You're just waiting and hoping we all move out soon.
And if you want a definition of white privilege, she just gave it to you, folks, because that's exactly what happened. My parents, God bless them, still in our family home in Petworth. Mom just turned 93 last week. Dad will be 88 in October. And their yard was, I get over and try to cut it, but when I was traveling, it was tough. So the yard, to your point about the yard getting overgrown, so I said, all right, fine, I'm going to do like white folks. I'm just going to hire service to come in and cut their grass every 2 weeks.
Take care.
Because I don't need nobody coming up making a complaint, because if the moment they do, I'm going to forget I was the former lieutenant governor of Maryland and have to show them just how black I really am. I want to shift to, because all of this really connects to your book, I'm Not Dying with You Tonight, in which you tell the story of two teens, a black female, white female, Lena, the African-American character, and Campbell, the white, and they have some moments. They have some realizations about race and inequality, As a result of having to go through and literally survive racial tensions and violence that blew up in their city. Walk us through that story and how you see that narrative playing out in this moment with George Floyd's death.
Wow, there are so many connections between what happened and I'm Not Dying With You Tonight and what's happening now. And one of the things that Geely and I wanted to do was make sure that we were bringing kids into the conversation, right? Because kids are actually experiencing these moments with us, but people are not listening to their voices. People are not allowing them the space to process these moments in time and these atrocities and to understand what's going on. And I think that kids are smarter than we realize that they are, that they are aware that they have a stake in what's happening and how it's going to affect their future. And they are listening to the side conversations that we have. They're listening, you know, from the other bedroom when you're watching, you know, the nightly news and having commentary with your spouse about what's going on. And so we're not realizing how they are going out into the world and representing the information that they are receiving at home. And so that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to put these girls in the thick of a situation and force them to have uncomfortable conversations and for you to see how differently their perspective is from a black female and a white female and how they view the neighborhood and how they view the riots and what's happening in their community. And so we've utilized it as a tool, Geely and I, when we're traveling to different high schools and touring different high schools, to give the kids a tool to have a conversation, difficult conversations. We were at a teacher's conference and a teacher from Ferguson came up to us and said, some of my kids were in middle school when the Ferguson unrest happened, and no one has introduced a space for them to process what happened in their community. And so I gave them all of your book to read as an assignment. It's the first time some of these kids talked about their feelings and processed it. And I think that that's happening again, because I've been out there on the front lines and the unrest here in Atlanta, and it's young people by and large that are out there. It's not Gen Xers like me. It's not Gen Xers and baby boomers that are out there. It's young people that are out there on the front line. And so I'm excited that there is now this dialogue that is happening with young people. And I think that, you know, obviously it's going to take some wisdom and some structure to think about what we're going to do on the other side. But I think we need to like bottle up that energy that they have and give them a voice in this moment. And I hope that they're inspired to do that by what they're seeing and by reading books like mine and, you know, American Boys by Jason Reynolds and different things like that.
So you touch on, I think, an important element of racism. A lot of folks don't really want to even begin with, and that is that it's not something that is innate to you when you're born. You're not born a racist. You don't come out of the womb with that.
No, it's nurtured.
It's nurtured. It's a learned attitude, behavior. And when I was reading some of the book to sort of prep and get in my head how to talk with you, because again, I was like, okay, this is a big moment. I got to be smart when I talk to Miss Jones here. And I was thinking about a conversation I had with a friend of mine. I'll never forget this one. All right, so you know, you don't mess with sisters. You just don't. And so she was
not a good idea.
So she. Oh my God, it's so funny. She had a little boy, young mom, living in D.C., living in the DuPont Circle area at the time. This was the early 1990s. So she had her son, she and her son were at DuPont Circle in the park. And for folks who don't know, in Washington, D.C., it's sort of upper Connecticut Avenue, just above downtown, nice little neighborhood, you know, with little shops. A lot of white folks live there. So, but it's nice. So she was out the park with her kid, and she was on the bench, and her son was playing in the grass with his toys and some distance away. And this little white boy comes up. And as kids do, right, they start playing, right? Mm-hmm. My friend's son has trucks. Little boy sees trucks. He's like, oh, dude, come on, let's do this. So they start playing in the dirt.
Yeah, it's going to be a good time.
They're having a good time. His mother walks up. Lord help us. His mother walks up, snatches her son up. This white woman snatches her son up. He's a white, little white kid. Snatches him up and says to him, I told you I didn't want you playing with them. Right? That's all she said. My friend heard this, right? First off, she looked at this woman. Why is this woman snatching her kid up? What happened, right? And this is a young white woman. This is not some, you know, grandmother. This is a woman about her age in her late 20s, early 30s. My friend goes over and looks at this woman, tells her son, come here, baby. Turns around, smacks the shit out of this woman, slaps her, and says to her, how dare you teach your son to be a racist? And walked off. I was like, no, you didn't. And she said, yeah, I dared her to call the cops.
Yes, I did.
She said, because of all the things to injure my child, that is the greatest one. To teach your son to hate my child because of the color of his skin, because that's an injury my son will carry with him the rest of his life. I was like, okay, I got nothing. You got me. And it was that that stark moment. I told you she's crazy as hell, but she's like, yeah, you know, you don't do that. You just don't do that. But that's what your video was for me. That's what your book, I'm Not Dying With You Tonight, is about. It's that smack in the face to sort of get you to look at and realize what racism is, but more importantly, how we teach it to each other, how we impose it on others.
Yeah. And that's the issue, and that's the problem. It's like it is taught, and that implicit bias is taught. And that idea that the right answer can't, you know, a lot of people, you know, didn't like our book because they said the racism in it was subtle. And I said, often racism is subtle.
That's it.
You not have to, you know, yeah. A lot of times the racism is subtle. And that is, and it is that comfort in that that allows people to believe that they couldn't possibly be racist, right? Because they're not like burning a cross in someone's lawn, so they're definitely not racist. And I'm like, no, that moment when you're in a meeting and you look across at the African-American woman who's pitching an idea and you decide that the idea isn't good enough just because it's her, that's racist. And that's holding that person's back. That's holding that person's growth back. And so it's an implicit bias that people need to really unpack in a real way if we're going to have any progression.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You got to, it's so important. The point you just made, and folks, I really, you've got to really appreciate the power of the subtlety of racism. What I call the new racism, the new form of it. It's clean. It's sanitized. Mm-hmm. It comes in khakis and, you know, pullover shirts with a nice with tiki torches and nice pair of loafers. It's subtle as hell, and you see it, you feel it every day when people ask you questions you know they damn sure wouldn't ask a white person, like, what are you doing here? When you're sitting at a Starbucks having a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to have more conversation with the incredible Kimberly Jones, author, activist, truthsayer. We'll be back with more after this.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
All right, everybody, welcome back again. We are speaking with Kimberly Jones, and we're talking about her book, I'm Not Dying With You Tonight, written with her co-author, Gilly Siegel. So Kimberly, what, and this one may be a question you may not want to get too much into, but then again, if your video is any indication, I don't think you'll have a problem. What are we getting wrong right now? And what are we getting right at this moment? And when you look at, okay, from the moment the video happens and we all digest it, you're right, we're home, we absorb it, people get upset, they go out, they're marching, Lafayette Park happens, yada, all this stuff, yeah. The mayor paints Black Lives Matter on the street, the country is boom. And now we're seeing this rush. Everybody wants to legislate shit. Everybody, and I always tell people this is the worst time to do legislation because all it is reaction. No one's thinking it through. So what are we getting right and what are we getting wrong in your estimation at this point?
I think the thing that we are getting wrong is that the desire to rush in, the desire to profiteer on the moment, the desire to want to be, you know, pinged in history as one of the game changers, but not with an idealist, you know, not with a plan that actually makes sense.
Or accountability.
There are people who have been trying to or accountability. And also there's a whole lot of separation of these people are terrible. And now I am going to tell you why I am great and what I'm doing. That's so great. Look at me.
Right.
And it's just like, we don't need any of that right now. Like nobody needs to have, want to have their moment to be like, I was on the right side of history. Did you see it? I think there are people who have been working on real legislation that can have a grand change. And we all need to shut up, sit down, turn to those people and go, look, I know you've been working on an economic bill for 6 years. Can we take a look at it now? I know that you've been working. I know you've been on a commission that's been trying to figure out how we police better in the 21st century. Can we take a look? Can we now take a look at that?
Mm-hmm.
People who have been doing the work when they were not in a heightened state, where they were not trying to, and no one knows this better than you. You rush in with a bill that's not well thought out. It's not going to go anywhere.
Right, exactly.
And it's just going to be lip services and it's going to fall flat. It may get through Congress if it's having a good day. It's definitely not going to get through the Senate. And so that's really not the plan right now. The plan right now is for everybody to continue to do what they've been doing and slow down and listen, and let's wait for the dust to settle a little bit, and then let's start looking at who the real, think tank people should be, and looking at some people who have already been working on these plans, and bring in some new, fresh eyes to see how they can be developed, and make sure that there are people on those commissions who understand thoroughly how government works and what it sounds like, looks like, feels like in those rooms, so we can actually get some legislation passed. And also some people who are like boots on the ground, people in the streets saying, this is really cute, this section you have here, but you haven't talked to the people in 30 years, and I'm telling you, this ain't what the people want. And so we're going to have some really smart commissions put together to get some real work done. I don't care what the head of the NFL is saying right now. Sir, sit down, because that's not what you were saying 5 minutes ago. Nobody is interested in your pandering right now. Just hush it.
Be quiet. Right. Well, that's legitimate. I think that's a legitimate point. Absolutely. I mean, it was called to your attention, and all of a sudden, you're like, That was then, this is now.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, we need to attack this. And listen, I'm sure people can tell this by my rants. For me, all of the shenanigans is rooted in economics. I think if you start to fix the economic disparagement, and not just for Black people, but I think that's where it needs to begin, because our house is on fire. But I think if you need to look at poor people in America across the board, it's insane. The fact that I have volunteered for and donated to so many programs that are put in place for kids who are food insecure, who the dominance of their food intake is happening when they're at school, that's an issue.
Yeah,
and you're surprised that somebody's walking through a glass window when we have kids who don't eat on the weekend?
So let's unpack the economic piece a little bit more, because I referenced earlier the point that you made about Rosewood and Tulsa. I won't call it a rant. I call it an education, what you did.
Mm-hmm.
And something struck me a while back, and I guess it's just from my years on this planet and in this mess, that I realized, everyone's running around talking about Oh, until, you know, 2043, America will be majority black and majority Hispanic. Hey, yeah, we going to run it. We got it. And I said, no, hold time out. You nothing. You'll be more than South Africa. That's all you're going to be in South Africa in 2043. Because you won't control the money and you won't have the power. And those two ingredients are essential.
And then people from other nations are going to move in and control them.
Hello.
Well. All these people we owe so much money to.
Hello. So tell us the...
Y'all do know we owe everybody.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And guess what? And the bill's going to fall on us. It's going to fall on the everyday Joe and Jane out there who try to make ends meet and try to keep this thing afloat for themselves, their communities, and the country. It's going to fall on us. And you look, I won't even get into the politics of the bull that, you know, my party's been out here starting with Trump coming in the door and spending $2 trillion we didn't have. And now we've spent another $3 trillion. So we're like, we've added $5 trillion to the debt and we're still nowhere clear. And yet that bill's going to come due on your kids, your grandkids, in communities like ours, in that by the time 2043 rolls around. So that's why we ain't going to have nothing. How was the Rosewood and the Tulsa stories instructive in this moment on the piece you're talking about with respect to the economics and the systemic financial oppression that this country continues to impose when it comes to our ability to truly wealth create?
Yeah, it's because those were spaces where we were, especially when you're talking about Tulsa, right? Because Tulsa had over 600 businesses, like 50 churches. I mean, it was like an epicenter of black wealth. That's why people refer to it as Black Wall Street, because that financial growth that they had was trickling out beyond the Greenwood. It was the neighborhood that, you know, the area that was in Tulsa that had that was Greenwood, and Greenwood was trickling out to other places. You know, they were getting into shipping things and taking services in from other nearby communities. And so it was starting to spread out before the Tulsa massacre. People like to call it the Tulsa riots. I like to call it what it was, the Tulsa massacre, before the Tulsa massacre happened. The same thing was happening in Rosewood. With the interesting part is, since that video went viral, I've had people continuously send me other cities in which that happened, and I think I'm up to about 30 now. You're talking about something that happened in Nova Scotia. There was the killing of the sharecroppers in Florida, the killing of 856 sharecroppers in Florida, and so it's all of these places, and then individualized too, right? So when you think about lynchings and stuff that took place in the 50s and 60s, by and large, the men who were lynched were men who were business owners, pastors of churches who owned property. And the reason that they lynched them is because they were deemed troublemakers. So you were, again, taking out men who were not only head of household, but who were building economic wealth and starting black businesses, you know, as individuals in community. And so there has been no wealth to pass down. So with each new generation of African American people to build wealth, everyone was having to start at scratch.
Start over.
Everyone was like, each generation was starting over. So it was like, okay, we were doing great in the 20s, and you had the sharecropper murder in Tulsa and Rosewood, and then it's like, all right, now it's the 50s and the 60s, and we're starting over again. And you had the lynchings that took out business owners and leaders and pastors and things like that. And then you get beyond that, and then they start things like mass incarceration and redlining. And with mass incarceration, you're giving felony charges to people who really are committing misdemeanor level charges.
Misdemeanor crimes,
and now, and it's like insane. And so now these people can't do what? Well, they can't go to certain schools. They can't get certain certifications. They're limited on the job, on their job prospects. So that's an attack on, you know, people's ability to be financially stable. So people serve their time and do their time, but they come out and they're not really a citizen because they can't vote. They can't get a job. They can't go to school. They have all these things that they can't do. And then they've been working in a prison where they've been getting paid 10 cents a day to make products for yet another corporation that's making money on free labor. It's like modern day slavery. And so it continues to recreate, slavery just continues to recreate itself. And slavery was an economic decision. It was an economic decision that people backed up by lack of human rights in order to justify it. It was an economic decision. And then they said, okay, we have to create this narrative where Negroes are the worst people on the face of the planet. So I could sleep well at night with having my slave that's building my business. I mean, I don't want to name any names because I don't want to get you in trouble, but there are corporations that right now are still making tons of money that have lineage money in their family where they either have still someone on the board or still someone receiving residual income from a company that made their money during slave time, who made their money during the slave trade. And so it's like, if you can be honest and accept this generational wealth that was built, you have to also be honest about the generational debt, because beyond just the finances of it, if you're not allowed to make money, then you don't have financial education to pass down to your family because you haven't had any money.
It's the core of something I worked on and tried to realize when I was lieutenant governor here in Maryland, and that was this idea of legacy wealth. Is the idea that you can pass on, you should be able to create something with your hands, with your mind, however you decide to create it, and be able to pass that on. And that piece was stripped away from us, that ability to pass it on. We were always and forever starting over, and always and forever.
Don't get me started on Freedman's Bank.
Go ahead. Because that's where trust me, I had my dance with some of the big banks when it came to their lending policies here in Maryland to black-owned, women-owned businesses in the state. And I remember sitting down with them at one point and just saying, how much money? Y'all have about $25 billion collectively from the state. My recommendation to the governor is going to be, we just take all our money out of your white banks and we put it in the black bank. We'll go from there. And all of a sudden they want to talk. Yeah. They want to talk about, how can we reform the system? How can we, I said, well, all right, now we can talk about redlining. We can talk about your lending practices, et cetera. But yeah, go ahead. I mean, I think that's important. That's part of the education. We need to know what these stories are out there. Yeah. So go ahead. Freedman Bank.
Yeah. Freedman's Bank is the reason why all of our grandmamas like to keep their money in a mattress instead of a bank.
It's so true. It's true. My mama. Go ahead. Yep.
It's so true. I mean, Freedman's Bank was a bank that was the only bank that was allowing black people to bank after slavery happened. And people were putting all of their money into this bank. And then the bank did a whole lot of shady dealing, closed down, took $50 million, which, you know, that's an extreme amount of money back then. We're talking like the 1920s or 30s or something, and took all of that money and then invested it in. And just conveniently, the president of the bank had all of this money magically to invest in the railroad. And that's how a lot of our railroad systems around that time were built, was from this multimillionaire who just happened to be the president of a bank that where all the black people put their money that collapsed and all of a sudden didn't have any money. And so you have to examine, first of all, none of this stuff is in the history book. Like, I'm prepared to like actually sit down with some of the creators of history books and say, I need to have a conversation with you too, because we need to recalibrate the whiteness that is American history and social studies that's taught in our schools, because the fact that people are missing these key pieces about how we got to where we are, the amount of white people who DM'd me, emailed me, called me, messaged me and said, I had never heard of Tulsa. I had never heard of Rosewood until your video. But then they've also never heard of Freedman's Bank, that we were basically robbed of this exorbitant amount of money that we had saved and invested. And then someone invested it in yet another business that they built to create generational wealth for their families. And so we have to keep in mind the government only, you know, the government controls, to me, how they allow these instances to happen. But at the end of the day, wealth is family based. The wealth in this country right now, we're all, you know, dependent on the old Walmart family because they were still open in the middle of the pandemic. That is a family institution. That is generational wealth for that family. And so it's like the fact that we weren't given that same space. And I'm talking about what happened with Freedman's Bank. Like you said, we're not even getting into how they don't offer loans to black businesses, and we can get in on insurances, how they price gouge insurance in poor communities. You're going to charge people who live in a poor community more car insurance on a 1987 Chevette than you do based on where they live, and you know that they can't afford it.
Right.
So now they don't have car insurance because they're making $10 an hour, and they just need that car to get their kids to school and get to their job at McDonald's where they're getting paid $9 or $10 an hour. And now you have the police sitting in their neighborhoods prepared to write tickets for everybody who's pulling them over and writing them a $1,500 ticket for not having insurance, which they can't pay. Now they go on probation, and then they're sitting in a car in the middle of the night, and they're drunk, and they're afraid that that probation violation is going to get them to go back to jail, so they run and someone shoots them in the back.
We just let that sit. Let that marinate. Because you just told a true life story. And we watched that video too. It is part of our narrative, and which is why what you said at the end of your education, your class, in the video was so powerful. You know, when you look at everything this country has done and continues to do to the black man, woman, and child, the fact that we still ask for equality and not seeking revenge says so much about us. About
us. We're a people of grace. Yeah, we're a people of extreme grace.
And it is. It is frustrating to me when that's not appreciated, and it is taken and it is used against us. It is treated with the kind of disregard and expectation that we need to be graceful in the face of their racism. We need to be silent in the face of their racism. We need to be accepting of their racism, because it's not really racism. Oh, no. We don't lynch anymore. We don't burn crosses on your lawns anymore. No, you use other forces and different means to strip our pride and strip away our humanity. And the story you just laid out there is just one example. Freddie Gray is another example. You know, where, again, the black man versus the system, the black woman versus the system, the black child versus the system. How then, and I'm going to let you go after this because I could talk to you all day. how then do these protests that we see now differ in your mind from those during the civil rights era? Some of the obvious notwithstanding, okay, you know, social media in the 1960s, and I saw a great clip of you talking about if Martin Luther King had Facebook, right? You know, just sort of, just wow, organization would have been a whole lot different. But
a whole lot different.
How do you see similarities or differences, impact? How do you assess the moments that galvanized the nation in the 1960s that brought some whites to the side of African Americans to stand with them in the fight, versus when you look now and you see, and I think I saw a clip of you as well where you even mentioned this point that in some of these protests, there are more whites there than blacks out there protesting. Mm-hmm. How do you assess this moment? And how do you see it going forward? What do you think it looks like?
I think what it looks like is this time it won't just be us that'll be celebratory of the changes that get made. Because I think people are delusional when they think that Martin Luther King was celebrated when he was alive. And he was not.
Even black ministers were like, Martin, come on now. Yep.
You just call you a little troublemaker.
Yep.
We got some good stuff going here and you in the way.
Yep.
I think for the first time that the applause and the Amen choir is going to be more than just us. And I'm hopeful. I'm not sure, but I'm hopeful that that will allow for sustainability.
Well, I hope you're right. And I
do too. Lord, I hope I'm right.
Yeah, no, I do. No, I really do. I hope you're right. And more importantly, I need you to be right. I need you to be right. And we all need you to be right in that hope. And because the reckoning is still ahead of us. And I think we need to understand and appreciate that. The reckoning is still ahead of us. And I think you summarized that in the last minute and 32 seconds of the video, which I'm going to play in its entirety, because I think your words sort of speaks to that reckoning. And I think that's important for people to appreciate, because for me, that was the moment that just, I was like, shit, oh, she's right. Damn, this is it. That was that moment for me. And I think it was for a lot of people as well, because it connected the biggest dot that had yet to be connected. And for me, you know, you start off that portion of the video with that question, how can you win? And my response immediately when I heard you say that at the end of that was, this is why we can't win. This is why we can't win. And it's because of the things that have happened and continue to happen to us, a lot of which we've talked about today. Kimberly Jones, I just can't thank you enough for taking the time.
Oh, it was my pleasure, and I was honored to be on with you.
Oh, and
I'm a huge fan.
Oh, same here. You keep it real out there for folks. And you know, Atlanta is still in many respects the sort of the modern day Tulsa. It is the Black Wall Street. It is where a lot of good things happen. You're part of that down there in Atlanta. We appreciate you. Folks, check out I'm Not Dying With You Tonight. It's a great read. It's an important read. And I'm going to leave you with not where to find me on Twitter and all that. You know that stuff. I think this more important moment is too important for all of that. You guys know that. I'm going to leave you with the words of Kimberly Jones, which to me answers a lot of questions for a lot of us and connects the biggest dot in the room.
How can you win? How can you win? You can't win. The game is fixed. So when they say, why do you burn down the community? Why do you burn down your own neighborhood? It's not ours. We don't own anything. We don't own anything. There is, Trevor Noah said it so beautifully last night. There's a social contract that we all have, that if you steal or if I steal, then the person who is the authority comes in and they fix the situation. But the person who fixes the situation is killing us. So the social contract is broken. And if the social contract is broken, why the fuck do I give a shit about burning the fucking Football Hall of Fame, about burning a fucking Target? You broke the contract when you killed us in the streets and didn't give a fuck. You broke the contract when for 400 years we played your game and built your wealth. You broke the contract when we built our wealth again on our own by our bootstraps in Tulsa and you dropped bombs on us. When we built it in Rosewood and you came in and you slaughtered us. You broke the contract, so fuck your Target. Fuck your Hall of Fame. As far as I'm concerned, they could burn this bitch to the ground. And it still wouldn't be enough. And they are lucky that what Black people are looking for is equality and not revenge.
You're local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to LostGolfBalls.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. LostGolfBalls.com.